You're listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 51. Hello and welcome to today's show. It's so good to have you here. Today we've got an interview with a dyspraxia expert because after dyslexia, dyspraxia is the most common learning difference that I hear about in my work, and it's something that I know even less about than dyslexia, and I think there's even less common knowledge and understanding of what it is. So I just wanted to bring an expert on to enlighten me and you about what dyspraxia is and what you can do to help your child if they have dyspraxia. Before we go over to today's interview though, I just wanted to remind you that the law changed last week about how I'm allowed to store your personal information and use it. So if you've signed up for my email updates in the past, maybe you've signed up for a freebie on my website like the exam season toolkit or a free chapter of my book or something like that, then unless you've let me know in the last few weeks, I'm no longer allowed to send you emails. So what I'd really love you to do, if you would like to continue receiving my emails, is come on over to my website, and I've created a special page where you can sign up for my weekly newsletter. You don't get a freebie or anything, but I will send you freebies over time as I make them and they become available. But my weekly newsletter comes out for parents on a Thursday and for students and teachers on a Friday, and it contains links to the most recent free content that I've created. So that might be a podcast episode or a blog post. And I've also started linking back to archive content because I've been creating content for over three years now. And that means that there's an awful lot there that you might not know is necessarily there. So I'm trying to find timely and seasonal stuff to share with you from the archive as well. And not only do I share this with you, I share news about what's going on in my business, maybe how you can work with me, and anything else that I think is helpful and relevant, insights of wisdom, inspiration, all that kind of stuff. So if you'd like to receive that newsletter, please come on over to my website and you can sign up for it at lifemoreextraordinary.com/newsletter, or if you go to today's show notes, which you'll find at lifemoreextraordinary.com/51, you'll find a link to join the newsletter there as well. And yeah, I'd love to get to know you. So when you sign up, reply to me and, you know, let me know a little bit about who you are, and I'll be sure to get back to you so that we can actually get to know each other a bit and I can do my best to create things that will actually help you with the problems that you have. Okay, that's enough of an introduction for today. So let's go over to today's interview. Our guest today is an occupational therapist with a special interest in neurological practice. She undertakes regular clinical work as well as managing Dyspraxia UK. She has many academic qualifications in this area, as well as being trained in the use of an innovative serious play technique using Lego, and is a qualified handwriting tutor. So welcome to the School Success Formula, Rosaline van der Weijer.
Thank you, Lucy. I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. So firstly, Rosaline, I'd love to get a little bit of background detail about my guests. So can you tell us a little bit about how you became interested in dyspraxia and neurodiversity?
Absolutely. I mean, I've always been interested in neurology, and I've been really fortunate to work at some really great centres such as Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge and the National Neurology Hospital in London. But that tended to focus more on rehabilitation, people that had more sort of acquired brain injury and stroke and long-term conditions such as multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's. But obviously neurodiversity is very different to that. I have a colleague who tends to work with children as a paediatric occupational therapist, and she had been doing lots of work with children with dyspraxia, and she had received some training, advanced training on the assessment techniques, and was really excited about it and said, "Roslyn, you really must do this training with Frances Beaumont. She's an occupational therapist based in Kent." And I'd never seen Sarah really so excited about this training. It was really nice, and often some of the best training and education comes by word of mouth. I don't know if you found that, Lucy.
Yeah, no, it's true, yeah.
So I did this advanced training, and it was just a revelation. And I felt like I hadn't probably done as much in my occupational therapy basic training in child development. And bearing in mind, I'm an adult. I obviously am an adult, but I tend to work with adults. I'm not really a paediatric occupational therapist. That's my background. And I always sort of thought, well, you'd have to know about child development, really, if you're working with children. However, this advanced training taught me a lot about sensory integration and just about how, as young people and teenagers and adults, we continue to learn through our environment, through touch, taste, smell. And anyway, this training was fantastic. And I thought it just brought a lot of my neurology interest all together. Mm-hmm. And I started doing some independent work alongside my NHS work under the sort of specialist guidance of Frances Beaumont, who was very experienced in the development of this assessment field. And it just went on from there.
Okay, fantastic. So it was just a happy accident almost.
Well, do you know, it was a chance, the fact that I'd had this colleague really excited about this training and thought I'd be very interested, and she was right. And then also the fact that I could go on the course at that time. I think otherwise my career path would have been quite different. Mm. But incidentally, I've got my own family now, but actually my son has dyspraxia.
Okay.
And so, which is sort of astonishing, really, in since I've gone down this avenue in terms of my own work. And it's been interesting from a sort of family perspective.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so I think it would be really helpful to start with a definition of dyspraxia, because I actually have no idea what it is. And I hear the term used quite frequently, and I think it'd be really helpful for the audience to know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, dyspraxia is the word that's commonly used in schools and workplaces. So it's spelt D-Y-S, the dis part. And that really, it's got its basis in Greek, and that means difficulty.
Okay.
The second part of the word, praxia, really means planning and automatic organisation of movement. So the entire word, dyspraxia, is really the difficulty in the ideation, planning and organisation of automatic movement. I mean, that is a bit of a mouthful, really, let's be honest.
So it's to do with movement of the body, is it? It's not to do with planning ideas, or yes, is it both?
It's really, there are three components. The first part is having the idea to do something. Mm-hmm. So it's the ability of the brain to think about what the body needs to do, which really should become automatic once a skill is learned. For example, swimming or riding a bike. When you're learning it, you're having to really think about the movements. Mm-hmm. Once you've got that idea, you know what you need to do.
Yeah, you've kind of got that neural pathway, haven't you? You've got
right.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
For the ideation, the child may have to cognitively work out which action is needed each time, even though they've performed the action previously. So sometimes learning things can take longer. So that's the first part, the ideation. Mm-hmm. You've got to have the idea about what to do. The second part is motor planning. So that means the ability to organise one's body for the action without having to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So with dyspraxia, the person has to consciously think actions through, and sometimes at the expense of the task at hand. So you have to really concentrate on planning how you're going to organise your body to pick up that glass of water without knocking it over or using too much force to break glass.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got to execute the task. So the ability to respond to input from the environment and make the right movement. So in technical terms, this is called like a motor adaptive response, something that we learn to do from the moment we're born in response to incoming sort of stimuli from around us. Mm-hmm. Practice refines the movement. You know, at birthday parties when you were younger, they have those like squashy cups. You know, those little plastic cups or those fruit juice cartons where you put the straw in and you have to be really careful not to squeeze it too hard before you get covered in juice.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really good example of knowing, even though we all know they're an absolute pain, you get covered in juice when you piss, that it's learning the force. It's having to learn, you plan differently that motor movement when you have that drink.
Okay, so just to kind of make sure that I understand it, so it's some kind of delay in developing the idea about what you're actually going to do, then it's having to think about it harder about how you're going to do it, so it takes longer to make it an automatic thing, and then finally it's more difficult to kind of manage that movement in the moment when it's happening.
Yeah, you've really summed it up nicely, Lucy. You know, you're quite right. And if you imagine your brain as like our brains around memory, really, is like a filing system. Mm-hmm. Imagine one of those filing cabinets where you pull out the drawers and you've got all of the slots in place. And really, it's organizing all of these memories and motor planning memories. And occasionally, we're just practicing. The filing system gets a bit muddled up, or sometimes the memories are stored in slightly different random places, so it's harder to retrieve.
Okay, so I've got a question, because I was actually at university with a girl who was dyspraxic, and I was under the impression then that she was kind of at a disadvantage because she found it difficult to kind of plan and structure information, which when you're doing an essay-based subject at university is a real disadvantage. Does that make sense within the context of what you've explained to me today?
It does indeed. I think even though we've talked about it in a very physical way, obviously the brain is such a complex organ. Doctors and neuroscientists are still trying to understand the brain. It's not just confined to movement. So we know as well that it has an impact on just what you've described. So being able to plan and organise your thoughts in a structured, coherent way, to organise yourself and your belongings and those sorts of things. I think now there's much greater knowledge about it, Lucy. I think there are much more sort of concessions in place. So, for example, as I know you're well aware, students can use resources such as mind maps, magnetic whiteboards to get their ideas onto to much more sort of visual cues and use colour.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and I've got some resources about that. If listeners are interested, I'll link to some resources about using flashcards, mind maps and post-it notes for that kind of thing in the show notes. Yeah, so, I mean, for me, one quite important academic skill for students to kind of make that jump between basic learning and knowledge and basic understanding and knowledge and actually to begin to analyse and synthesise material is to be able to categorise knowledge. Is categorisation something that dyspraxic children would find difficult?
Quite possibly, only in the sense that often the way that, if you like, a conventional teaching approach would put across may not be so obvious to somebody with dyspraxia or any other neurodiversity like dyslexia or ADHD or autistic spectrum conditions. People with neurodiversity, and I sort of include all of those with this, using different sorts of sensory input is really, really helpful. So, for example, audio, like your podcast. Mm-hmm. So using that auditory input is really powerful. So, for example, being able to audio record a key lecture or I mean, lots of universities now do record lectures, and you can listen back to them in the bar, not in the bath on a walk, or but you can. And it's not just relying on the sense of being in the space at that time or having to capture information by handwriting. There is so much emphasis in schools, from primary school up really, into capturing all knowledge by the hand. Mm-hmm. And having much, but again, schools are fantastic now. They've got these smart boards, lots of it. So there's a lot more visual information that can be remembered.
Okay, so I mean, the message I'm getting through to you from you here is that the most important thing to help students like this is to vary the way of recording and understanding information away from just writing things by hand.
Yes, think multi-sensory all the time. Multi-sensory. Use if you're just in people's bedrooms at home, having a decent pin board so you've got key documents pinned up, timetables. Use smartphones. Most of us underutilize the equipment we've got.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can record on smartphones. I mean, it is courteous to let the tutor know that you are recording,
yeah.
Of course. But you, because like a smartphone, everyone's got one. It's not disability equipment. You can do so much with that. And in terms of also using photographs as a record, so photographing key PowerPoint slides or asking for things before. In your at university, we often, for some of our university students, we often recommend. Am I allowed to recommend products, Lucy?
You can. I'm just thinking we're kind of skipping a bit ahead here because we're talking about strategies to actually cope with it.
Bring me in.
That's all right. So I was just wondering, tell me about certain tasks that people would find difficult if they're dyspraxic. So the kind of things that a parent might be seeing and thinking, this might be a sign of dyspraxia.
Yeah, okay. So if we start, I think what I'd like to do, if I take you through sort of early years, mm-hmm. and then go through to sort of primary and then secondary school.
Yeah, most of the listeners will be parents of teenagers, so yeah.
Okay, well, in that case, what we'll do is we'll skip straight to secondary school and then post 16.
Okay.
So I think really what many parents may have seen is that from that transition phase from primary to secondary school, where the young person's having to manage a huge amount of belongings, so carrying a school bag, having the right kit with them on the right day, taking the PE kit, managing a lot of their own things and having to navigate to different classrooms, mm-hmm. with the right equipment. I think that can be incredibly challenging and incredibly tiring for young people when they first start.
Yes, definitely. I remember it myself, and I remember being a year 7 tutor and seeing all these poor little people coming in and having to cope with it all in their first week and things at secondary school.
And for many schools, you know, they've got a new school uniform that will have perhaps awkward little buttons or set shirts they have to wear with these small hard buttons and buttonholes, zips, the fastenings. They may have football boots with laces and obviously trainers, smart school shoes, and all of these sort of fastenings. I mean, lots of children have mastered them by that point, but often these children, it just takes them more time. So the pressure's on when they're changing for PE or whatever it is, or dance or whatever they're having to get changed for. So that sort of physical load really ramps up at secondary school, as does what we call the cognitive load, mm-hmm. managing one's timetable and then managing to bring the right pieces of homework home,
yeah.
instructions, and to manage it. And I mean, it's difficult for any young person without difficulty. It's a big transition, but it is more so for young people with dyspraxia or any other neurodiversity. So there's some of the examples for secondary school. And I think post 16, really, you've got your thinking about learning to drive. That's a key one. So again, learning to drive, you've got the theory test, the hazard perception, as well as the actual learning to drive with your left. There's a whole new motor pattern. So you've got your left clutch foot, your the gear stick, it feels very alien.
Yeah.
I think the cost of automatic cars is slightly coming down, depending on the make model. Sometimes we're suggesting to go straight for learning in an automatic car. That's driving. And so the other post-16 issue often is independent living.
Mm-hmm.
So not only have you've got your studies, if you go away to college or university, you've got that double whammy of then having to self-care. What I mean by that is coping with one's laundry, knowing when things are dirty, knowing the routines of tidying your room. In a way, one could call it basic living, but actually when you break it down, that's a whole complex area, and having to perhaps cook for yourself, recognise when you're thirsty, when you need to go out with a coat.
Quite basic, kind of just monitoring of your senses and like bodily sensations and that kind of thing are difficult.
It is. No, absolutely. It certainly can be. And I think lots of young people just become reliant on verbal prompts, either from a carer or from a teacher, rely on these sort of verbal prompts. But when you're living independently, you haven't got somebody to say, oh, actually, do you know what? I think you need a new T-shirt today, or have you done your laundry? But these things, if they're not managed, have really big impact on your social life.
Mm. Yeah, like, you know, if you wear the same stinky T-shirt for, 20 days in a row, you're not going to have as many friends, are you?
You have a sense of smell, and you just don't notice, which is again, that it certainly affects everybody differently, but that is a common thing, perhaps not noticing. So the key to managing that then is getting into a routine. Of thinking, right, every second day, or I'll change my outer clothes, I'll change my underclothes every day, shower every day routine. But these are learnt behaviours that all of us can develop as habits.
Mm-hmm.
But this more high level noticing, sometimes it doesn't happen in the same way.
Okay, so just going back to kind of the beginning of the school, like secondary school, and that kind of level of disorganisation, like every student is going to struggle with that in the first week, fortnight of going to secondary school. But then, you know, the majority will kind of settle into a rhythm. So if your child's still struggling by the end of the first half term, you know, that might be a sign that they're, you know, that they have more difficulties maybe.
Yes, and I think were you meaning more, Lucy, in terms of managing timetables and things?
Or just your bag and having the right books in your bag every day, or remembering your PE kit. I mean, you know, I struggle with that with my own children.
Yes, absolutely. It's high level stuff. It sounds really obvious, but we always say in that summer holidays, go together, choose together a decent bag, a decent backpack that's got the right sort of a nice amount of compartments in, with padded shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really want a bag slung on one shoulder because that causes a muscle imbalance. Really want a nice backpack, and get into the habit of putting like a bus pass or locker key always in the same compartment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people paint a little bit of coloured nail varnish on the zip, you know, so you can quickly, you've got a visual cue. If you've got a big black backpack,
mm-hmm,
or a little piece of ribbon, if you put something quite discreetly on that zip as a cue, they know that the wallet or locker keys always in that. And okay, things like, sorry, I'm leaping onto strategies, aren't I, Lucy? Sorry.
No, it's all right. I just want to finish talking about, because, you know, a lot of the students that I work with revising for their GCSEs and A-levels. And so if they're dyspraxic, will they find it difficult to put together a revision timetable? Will they find it difficult to stick to it? Will they need extra help with kind of from somebody else in terms of like having file dividers and, you know, keeping notes organised and all that kind of thing? Is that the kind of thing that we're thinking of?
Really practical things like that. And I think if procrastination is an issue, getting down to actually do the work. I use one myself, and I recommend them to lots of students. is a like a little timer. I mean, you can set a timer on your phone, mm-hmm. little cube timer that you just turn over for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, 15 or half an hour, and just break the time into chunks and revise in different environments as well. If you're always in your room, or always in a set space, break it up, go somewhere where or leave your social media behind, you know, limit all of those things that come in. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's just kind of advice that I would give to anybody. It's not just advice for dyspraxic students, so it's good advice for everybody, really, isn't it? So I think what I really want to get to here is kind of, you know, how can you tell that your child needs extra support and help? I mean, parents will know that if their child is maybe a little bit different, needs a bit of help, but when do you actually think I need to go and seek a kind of diagnosis or extra support on top of what I can give my child at home?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think I always say parents are the experts of their children. Mm-hmm. You know your child better than any other. And sometimes if you've got siblings that you compare to as well, you'll have a feel for how long it took one child to hold a pencil and write their name and how long it took the other one. I mean, and you'll have a little feeling for when they're at the park and how they're moving around on the climbing frame in comparison to their peers, how they run, feedback from teachers at parents' evening, and general sort of the presentation of their work and the way that they think and verbalise stories to you. I mean, you'll have a feeling yourself as a parent. And to be honest, all of us are a bit, quirky in our own way. But it's only a problem, and this is the key thing, it's only a problem if you are at a disadvantage in comparison with your peers.
Okay, so if it's actually... it's slowing your progress or making it difficult for you to access the curriculum or that kind of thing.
So may I give you an example, Lucy? Mm-hmm. So very recently, I've seen a few students like this who were about to do their GCSEs. They were diagnosed when they were quite young with dyspraxia. Mm-hmm. Supportive families and their physical problems weren't too severe in some senses, but very keen scientists, and they were doing some chemistry experiments, but all of the really fine clamps, you've got the Bunsen burners and these very fine glass sort of vials, mm-hmm. it was taking a lot longer for them to set the experiments up because of this reduced touch sensation and tactile ability. Mm-hmm. So things were being dropped and spilt, and it came back that their confidence, as soon as it has an impact upon the person's self-esteem and confidence, I mean, that's a big, big flag, really. But you want to get in before then. But the strategy that was put in place, really easy. We just asked the science teacher if they could borrow some of the equipment to practice setting it up at the weekend.
So they cement those neural pathways so that
they're... And so they have more practice with it. And a lot of it's relying on vision rather than touch. Yeah. But and occasionally, if appropriate, a little bit of additional time as well. And so those students that they can do it, they can work it all out, but it just takes longer.
Yeah. So the point at which you seek help or a diagnosis is when it's actually impacting your child's self-esteem. Is that the kind of line in the sand?
Really, you'd want it before then. Yeah, I mean, ideally you want it before then, because then you've got an additional mental health issue, is the truth. You want to get in before that. I mean, the only point, really, of having a diagnostic assessment is to give your child and yourself more information about the strengths and challenges. If you like, increasing their self-insight, it's nice. They know what's hard. It's also nice to know what's working really well. Mm. If they meet this diagnostic criteria, then it does mean that they can access concessions. Mm-hmm. Without that diagnosis, if they've been told, you've got dyspraxic traits, that is not sufficient to grant or apply for additional time. It's very strict in gaining those concessions. And if I just may say, so in terms of the diagnostic criteria, it's now called developmental coordination disorder. So you'll hear the term DCD or developmental coordination disorder and dyspraxia used a bit interchangeably, which is incredibly confusing at times. But it's the diagnostic manual is called the DSM-5, and it's the diagnostic manual that originates in America, mm-hmm. Which is adhered to here, and it's a very strict criteria as to how that diagnostic work is done. So it's certainly not undertaken lightly. You know, the process is careful, but it gives you self-insight into your own abilities and then helps you self-support.
Yeah. It's
getting concessions. It helps you to think, actually, do you know what? I'm a visual learner. I really do like colour coding. I really do need to listen to things on a podcast or via audio. It gives you more self-insight. And I think knowledge is power, isn't it?
Definitely. And that's an approach I encourage, you know, in my book. I talk about, you know, how you need to know how you learn best. And, you know, that applies to every student, whether they're, you know, they pick things up like in seconds or whether it takes them twice as long as the rest of the class. You need to know what works for you, don't you, in order to have the most easy and efficient learning possible.
Absolutely. And I think, and again, I mean, even though something like dyspraxia or DCD or dyslexia or any of the other neurodiversities, they have set diagnostic criteria or set markers to be met to facilitate that diagnosis. However, every person that I've met, older students at university, secondary school, primary school students, people present so differently. We all live a bit differently. We have different environmental factors. And so an individual approach, not one set concession is going to be the right thing for everybody. So I think teachers, employers, you know, we have to listen to what the person's saying very carefully and to understand actually how we can meet needs, because one strategy is certainly not going to meet everybody's need.
It's not a one-size-fits-all thing. No. So what other learning differences are often seen alongside dyspraxia? You've mentioned dyslexia before. Do they typically kind of present together, or, you know?
Well, they can do. So I like to sort of, if you imagine a brightly coloured umbrella with the label of neurodiversity on it, I think that's a lovely term. So a big encompassing umbrella, and then underneath that umbrella, you've got dyspraxia, also known as developmental coordination disorder, then dyslexia, attention deficit disorder, autistic spectrum conditions, and sensory processing issues as well. Mm-hmm. All of those things, I mean, you can be perfectly bright and cognitively able. It's really important to point that out with all and all of these neurodiversities. They can all exist independently of each other, but as you say, it's very common to have some overlap, mm-hmm. which then makes teasing out which thing to have an assessment for.
Which things?
And actually, I must include under that umbrella as well, auditory processing disorder, which is, if I just may briefly say, so for example, you may notice that the person isn't hearing, but then when you go and have physical hearing test, it comes back, oh yes, the hearing's perfect.
Yeah.
Yet it's the slowness in that, if you like, that neurological level processing of the auditory information, that can also come under that.
Yeah, I'm going to ask a student with that as well. So, I just wanted to pop in there that I've got various podcasts on most of the things that you've just talked about there, like dyslexia, ADHD, we've got one on Asperger's syndrome, we've got one on sensory processing disorder as well. So I'll link to all of those in the show notes if people are interested in going back and looking at those as well. Okay, so another point I wanted to make is that dyspraxia isn't nearly as well known as dyslexia in schools and by the general public. Is it more difficult to get it diagnosed, and is it more difficult to get the help that children need because there's less of a kind of public consciousness around it?
I would say yes in a succinct answer to that. But I will say I think there's some really excellent work being done by the National Charity Dyspraxia Foundation. Mm-hmm. They've done a huge amount of awareness raising on the topic, and they've got some fantastic free little brochures that can be downloaded from the Dyspraxia Foundation website on secondary school classroom guidelines, post 16 strategies, those sorts of things. So that charity is working really hard to increase awareness, and they had a slot on the Victoria, I think, Derbyshire show this year as well.
Yeah.
But I will say, I mean, 20 years ago, dyslexia was just becoming known about in the classroom, and teachers were undertaking some serious training in the issue. So you'll now find that teachers, they talk about dyslexia with great familiarity, whereas I think dyspraxia or DCD is behind that, but it is coming. And I think there is more training certainly needs to be done. And because, again, all of these things, they're hidden disabilities.
Yeah.
Many of these students have fantastic verbal skills and are bright, and sadly can be deemed not trying hard enough or a bit lazy, which then you have...
Yeah, I can think of boys in particular who I've taught who are, like, almost mercurial in the way they can argue with you and, like, you know... It's amazing what they can say, but actually, if you look at their school bag, it is the pits. And you wonder, I mean, in the past, I would have said they were just badly organised, but actually, it could be that they're dyspraxic.
Mm. Absolutely. And sometimes, for some of the university students that I've seen, we've actually recommended, and it's been undertaken, that they do lots of their presentation work by sort of oral poster presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of doing some of these longer assignments, they can be assessed in a different way, using the skills they've got. And I think A-level and BTEC centres are being quite sort of innovative as well in the ways that they're assessing these children, because they've got so much to offer. I mean, these individuals are so superb to have in the workplace. They'll come up with the ideas that nobody's thought of that to seem really obvious. These, you've got the Richard Bransons of the world.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's just the exam system is lagging behind because most of it is written. I mean, there's some coursework and some practical work now, but there's less than there used to be. And you know, it's just thinking about how that can catch up, but it's not us that's going to solve that problem here today.
What I would say, if you've had a young person assessed and had a diagnostic report, it is really helpful, I think, from the college or school's perspective, if those professionals can actually have a conversation, the teacher and the psychologist or occupational therapist, making that link is really important because everybody's working for the good of the person, good of that child. And really, you do need this linked up working, and that's really when it works much better. So do open with the schools or colleges that you're seeking further assessment. Double check to see what they can provide in terms of assessment.
Yeah.
Do ask the GP, you know, because services have been really cut, and especially for this sort of assessment work. But people do need to be asking the GP for it, otherwise they won't know that the service is still required.
Yeah, and I think the point that I put in there is, you know, even if the school as a whole has been informed that your child has a learning difference like dyspraxia, it doesn't mean it's filtered down to the teacher, and it does, you know, the individual class teachers, particularly at secondary school, and it really doesn't mean that that teacher knows what strategies are going to work for your child. So, you know, actually, if you've got a child and then you know what works for them, actually making contact with each of the teachers individually and saying, this is what works for my child, this is what you can put in place that will really make a difference, will actually make a huge difference to the teacher. You know, I've been there where a parent has come in and said, you know, my child's got this, and I'm like, well, nobody told me about that. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, and then they reeled off all these strategies.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
I think that's really, the examples you've given are superb, and that brings me back to the point that knowledge is power. The more the child or young person understands themselves, mm-hmm. it gives them the vocabulary to be able to express to their tutor, oh, do you know what, could I have that printed off? Could you email me that? Can I sit nearer the front? Could I borrow that? It's giving the young person the confidence to, in a way, remind the teacher, because they're the ones there in that timely point. The teacher's got a class of 30 that rotates, goodness knows how many times a day.
You know, I used to teach over 300 students a week, and it's very difficult to kind of keep on top of what each individual one of those needs when you've got that kind of turnover. So, yeah, if...
It's empowering the student to take some responsibility for themselves. We've got fantastic supportive families, and I think... And you get supportive teachers as well. But ultimately, to make these children more resilient and equip them with the skills that they need, is they need to be able to explain how it impacts on them,
yeah.
and actually what they need to support themselves, and actually approach that as a really empowering process. It's not a disability. This is just what they need to do or have just to compete on equal terms with their peers. And I think that's a really big resource that you can give your child or a young person that you teach or come into contact with.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's move on to strategies properly now. So you've already shared quite a lot with us, but what would you say are the key strategies that you would share with parents of dyspraxic children?
Oh, gosh, Lucy, there, where do I start?
Yeah, I know.
Well, I must recommend... am I allowed to recommend a book, Lucy?
Yeah.
So there's a book that was published fairly recently in 2015, and it's called The Dyspraxic Learner: Strategies for Success. And that's written by a person called Alison Patrick. Mm-hmm. That's Alison Patrick, Strategies for Success.
Yeah.
And it's really nicely laid out. You can dip in and out of it. It's available online, and it really goes through literacy strategies in terms of visual processing, auditory processing. I mean, I really don't rewrite what's already been written. I'm really pro for recommending resources that are good and already out there. The section on effective study skills. It talks a little bit about the dyspraxic mind and the neurological effects about memory, strategies for sleep, thinking about repetitive thoughts, and also goes through the emotional consequences and then preparing for work. But I think lots of the things are very individual to the person as to where they're at. Is it a social issue? Is it a mental health problem? Ask me a question, Lucy, as to what to help me hone myself down.
Let's go back to this disorganized boy who, you know, he's never got the right book and pen, or, you know, he just doesn't bring the right stuff to school. Okay. What would you do with him?
So for somebody like him, I would find out what his workspace was like at home, and ask, what in his room would he have a way of, and we often recommend a set of really colourful drawers. They're really fairly inexpensive, these plastic coloured drawers. I think you get about 7 or 8 in a tower.
Mm-hmm.
A plastic, it's just on wheels from somewhere like Hobbycraft, but you've got these deep, different coloured drawers that you can then allocate for each subject.
Mm-hmm.
So in your room, you can, I think everybody thinks of allocates their colours differently. So what colour would you think of, Lucy, if I said maths?
Blue.
blue. Okay, it's funny, isn't it? For me, it'd be red.
I think it all stems back to the colour of your exercise books when you were at school.
There you go. So anyway, we would recommend that you use something like this, something really easily accessible that you just threw in all of that subject's related material, textbooks, paperwork, all of that. Mm-hmm. And at the same time had some sort of visual timetable next to it with colour blocks for when those subjects were and watched which day.
Okay, and then would you suggest having like a checklist or something that they use when they're packing their bag?
Maybe. That works. Some people really like lists. Some people hate writing them to start with. Mm-hmm. But you're right. But it's really the habit of the night before thinking, right, 10 minutes after I've cleaned my teeth, I'm going to spend packing my bag for the next day.
So it's about routines, really, isn't it? And making space for those routines in your life.
Yeah, building habits. And to start, and some people, to help build those habits, again, use their smartphones. So set a reminder on your smartphone, right, now's the time I'm going to pack my bag.
Brilliant.
And make sure it goes off and then you cancel it once you've done it.
That's a really good tip. Instead of lists, could you like have a poster that's got a picture of your pencil case, a picture of your books, a picture of your water bottle or whatever that you need? Would that be more appropriate to these kind of people?
No, it may. Well, for some people it might do. I know I successfully used with my own son, Ruben, and other students that have come through, something called a Tom Tag, and that's TOM and then capital TAG, Tom Tag. And they're produced by Orchid Ideas, who are based up north. And they produce these fantastic, like, they look like almost like a bookmark, one for each day, different colours for every day. And again, you can put in different pictures, and they do a set for about, it used to be around roughly £12-ish, for packing your bag every day of the week. So you'd have a different tag depending if it was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday or Friday.
Yeah.
And so you would look at your little mini picture list for that week. I mean, we found that incredibly helpful, because every day it's painful. Have you got your water bottle? Mm. No. Have you got your lunchbox? No. And it's boring. It's so boring for the parent as well as the child.
The question that I've got in my head now is, are dyspraxic kids more likely to resist these kind of routines, or do they actually welcome them because they find them helpful? I'm wondering,
I think helpful. I think very helpful, because these children are concentrating so much on everyday tasks. You know, they're navigating the playground. Some of these children are much more prone to tripping. They're not noticing curbs. They can, the expression of tripping over thin air. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the visual perception can be slightly off, estimating space, depth, and distance. So these children are working 110% all the time of the routine stuff, getting themselves to the loo, managing all the fastenings of the clothing. But they don't know any different, but it takes a lot more energy. And so then the things that we find important as a parent, like the water bottle or lunchbox or the PE kits, all of those things are sort of, they can be lost. And so having these, anything that helps give them that routine and strategy can only be a bonus, because if it's not working, then trying out different things together is key.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So I just want to throw another example at you of a kind of student. So if your child is constantly tripping over and, seems to not estimate space and maybe finds like sports and games a bit difficult because of that, what kind of things can you recommend to those parents and children?
Well, I suppose really, I always think start bottom up. Mm-hmm. Some children, again, not all, some children have slightly lax ligaments, not often enough to be hypermobile, but this hypermobility can exist as well. But sometimes children have quite flat feet, don't have the arches, And so you can see this easily if you look at your child's feet without their shoes and socks on. Do their ankles really roll in, or having wet feet and then standing on where you can do like a footprint, you mm-hmm. can sort of see how much of the foot touches. Occasionally things like bought online, you know, these orthoses that you can put in shoes that just generally correct, they can be popped in school shoes, they bring their ankles into a slightly better alignment. It might be worth talking to your GP first, mm-hmm. but obviously if your feet and your ankles and your knees all align properly, then that gives you a better start keeping balanced. Having your child's eyesight tested regularly, it's another job, but popping it on your calendar or in your diary to do every 6 months. And again, having a hearing test done. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it sounds basic, but I think in busy family life, sometimes those things can fall by the wayside.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if things like yoga or Pilates would help establish a sense of balance, like improving core strength and that kind of thing. Is that helpful?
Absolutely. Any weight-bearing activity like yoga or Pilates or anything, and actually martial arts are really good. Okay. Great, because you've got a sort of sequences that can be learned, but it's weight-bearing. And so any sort of, like, think of a press-up, or it gives each little joint gets a little push together, and you get this sense of self, or they call it like a proprioceptive sense. You get to feel where your body is in space.
Yeah.
And it really does help those sort of motor patterns. Okay. So they're anything like that's great. What's tricky often are team sports, mm-hmm. but by all means encourage your child to participate. But there's so much going on all at the same time. They're having to watch what's happening and coordinate where they need to be at the set time. So it's that in anticipation of timing. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly difficult. And so, for example, my son in football, because he couldn't anticipate the timing, couldn't get in the right place at the right time, let alone kick it correctly in the right direction, they put him in goal, which seemed like a really sensible idea. However, obviously, that's a really crucial football position. Mm. And then that was even worse, because then when he went the wrong way, the social impact was much more detrimental. So I think in the end, they ended up, did some sort of, got him learning some refereeing skills and helping, you know, doing some sort of more healthy jobs. But again, it depends on each child.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's been really helpful and really informative. Is there anything else you'd like to say to parents or teenagers as we just round up today, Rosaline?
Well, I would honestly say knowledge is power. The more you understand your own strengths and challenges, the better you'll be able to support yourself in life and actually enjoy life in its fullness. So I think assessments really do have their place, and read lots around the subject, and there are so many positives. And I think employers are often actively, you know, seeking neurodiverse people to add a new fresh perspective to the workplace. So there's really a lot of good stuff happening out there.
Fantastic. Okay, so if parents do want to find out more and maybe contact you, where can they find you online and on social media?
Yep, okay. So my service is Dyspraxia UK. Mm-hmm. So that's www.dyspraxiauk.com. Mm-hmm. It's a private assessment service. However, we freely give out advice on some ways that you can obtain assessments, and we often advocate going to your GP. But I must point you all to Dyspraxia Foundation. So Dyspraxia Foundation are the national charity, and they have some fantastic resources that are online. They're free. They also have a little helpline to answer any questions that are run by volunteers. So there is lots of good resources out there. And don't forget the Alison Patrick book. No. Dyspraxic Learner, Strategies for Success.
I'll put a link to all of those things in the show notes. So I just want to say thank you for making the time to talk to me and my listeners today. And it's been great to have you here.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a real pleasure to be asked, and I'm always keen to try and raise awareness as well about dyspraxia or developmental coordination disorder, as it's also known. Thank you, Lucy. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey, bye.
Wasn't that a great conversation with Rosaline? I have learned so much more about dyspraxia than I ever knew before and have a much better understanding. If you are interested in any of the resources that we talked about in today's show, you can find them in the show notes, which you'll find at lifemoreextraordinary.com/51. And don't forget about signing up for my newsletter if you'd like to receive my weekly emails. And you'll find that at lifemoreextraordinary.com/newsletter. Okay, one last thing to say today. The show is coming up to being a year old, and I've had some lovely feedback over the last few weeks, people saying that they really enjoy listening, and I would really love to see some of that feedback in the reviews on iTunes. So if you've got a spare minute, maybe even while you're listening through your app, please pop over and leave a review for the show. It would be lovely to get a few more reviews before the show actually hits its first birthday. Okay, all it remains for me to say is thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and goodbye.